right, so we left off dealing with 1917. 1917, the three major offensive, Naval offensive, third Battle of Ypres, and of course, Cambrai. These were all Allied offensives. Germany at this time was focusing on knocking Russia out of the war. The orders that went up and down the line was to basically hold the ground. Now, that's not saying that there weren't German units that did engage in localized clashes, but there were no big operations in 1917 on the Western Front, spearheaded by the Germans. The Allies tried. You saw what happened at the Nival campaign. French army almost mutinied. Not good. We saw what happened at the Third Battle of Ypres. They charged, they got through, it caused lots of destruction, but they ran out of steam, and in the end, the Germans countered and drove them back. Plus, it helped that they deployed mustard gas, too. That's always a good helper. But, despite the fact that the Third Battle of Ypres resulted in 245,000 casualties, Haig was not done. He was convinced that he could achieve his dreamed breakthrough in Flanders, which is one of the reasons why he started what technically was one of the latest starting of all of the operations in the West in November. At a time when the three previous years, this is when the fighting began to subside because of cold, of snow. Well, Haig says, nope, now's the time. 6:30 a.m., he launched an attack focusing on the small town of Cambrai. Why? Simple. Cambrai was the German hub in the Flanders region. That's where they had stockpiles of munitions, food, medicines, and other supplies. Haig believed if he could seize that, it would cause a complete collapse of the small strip north going to the channel. Well, that's about 150 miles. It's not like it's tiny. It's just a colorful little kid's map. But he believed this is where it could be achieved. The problem is, what Haig triggered was actually a shock. Because the Germans would introduce new techniques, which are now way more common on the battlefield than the techniques that were used in the First World War. The goal of the British was to use what was known as a combined arms approach, where they would stitch together tanks, artillery, and infantry, all in a seemingly singular mass movement. They also would use the modern tactics of predicted artillery fire. Meaning, instead of just opening the guns and telling to fire and fire and fire, before a single shot was fired, they engaged in all of the calculations, all of the pre-angling of the guns to designate the line where the fire was going to drop. They also used aerial reconnaissance to engage in accurate ranging. They also unleashed the tanks in direct coordination with the infantry, because these slow tanks going 4 miles an hour were basically sitting ducks. But if you could infest them with infantry soldiers, when the enemy was concentrating on the tank, that would allow the men to advance, or vice versa.
They also unleashed the largest tank force to date. 400 Mark IV tanks would be used. And out of sheer luck, because it was later, the frosts had already occurred. So the ground was firmer. So the tanks didn't go squish into the mud right off the bat. And prior to the attack, the Royal Flying Corps, had been training its soldiers for the first time in air-to-ground attacks. So the planes would go down and engage in strafing runs. And then fly off. Strafing. The RFC were assigned sets of targets prior to the attack. So you go strike this position, you go strike that position, you go strike that. They focused primarily on supply points and airfields. And, once again, they brought in a whole bunch of guns. 1,000 guns. Actually, it was 1,002 to be exact. But here's the catch. They didn't unleash a massive bombardment. Because as they learned from Ypres, when you spend a week blowing gun after gun after gun after gun, the Germans know you're coming, so they go down in their concrete shelters. This time, the attack would begin when the bombardment was fired. And the first round would come down and would be planned out on where the barbed wire was. Then the next volley would be smoke bombs to obscure the line of vision of the German soldiers. And then they would engage in a creeping volley, slowly blowing all of the barbed wire into the first trench, opening the door, so to speak. By the way, everything went according to plan. Everything went according to plan. Now, ironically, the one thing the British didn't know is that the Germans actually found out they were coming. Because just like it happened in other battles, POWs talked because they were convinced that the Germans were going to win. So what ended up happening? Well, it all goes crazy. Everything looks like they're winning. The first day alone, the British had their deepest penetration of the German lines in the entire war. Day one, they managed to get 5 miles beyond the front. And they experienced something they had not experienced since 1914. Open countryside. But that was day one. By day two, things had changed. The tanks were made to cross no man's land. But as the crews tried pushing them further, they began to break down. Roughly 60% of their tanks were done by the end of day one. Few of them were knocked out. Two, the thing they didn't realize, because the Germans knew they were coming, the Germans intentionally pulled their guns back 10 miles. So when the Brits entered into the open ground, well, guess what the Germans had already ranged out? That whole area. So essentially they charged into a trap. So on day two, when all hell unleashes, the advance falls to a stall. And the coup de grace, Haig went all in. He had no reserves. So all of his men penetrated into German territory. But there was nothing left. So as day two turned into hell, all the men he had were suddenly being bombed by German artillery. And the advance stopped. So much so, by day three, the German command felt that the battle was already over. Because the Brits literally were like in a bowl. They were trapped. So, what do? Well, they counter. 20 divisions. 20 divisions they had behind the lines and were just waiting to unleash them. The goal was to take back every last inch of land from the Brits. And it was achievable. Because by the first day of December, not only did they get all the land that they lost back, but they managed to take British territory. They actually advanced beyond the British trenches. So they completely flipped it. And how did they do it? Well, just like the Allies were doing something different, so too did the Germans. Instead of a massive movement of soldiers working in unison, the Germans would utilize what became known as the Hutter, or the Hutter infiltration tactics. Hutter involves light infantry divided into small groups. So the leading elements don't go as a massive wall, but they go in individual separated units. So it allows them to penetrate the enemy lines at different points. They did not attack entrenched positions. So if they knew there was a machine gun nest, instead of engaging, they went around. They encircled. Because following on their heels was the second wave of German soldiers. So essentially the fortified positions would be squashed like a pimple. Why is it called a Hutter? Well, because the German general, one of the commanding officers on the Eastern Front, Oskar von Hutter, was the man who developed these tactics. Soon these tactics would be used by specially trained Stosstruppen units, the stormtroopers. This was his most highly decorated unit from the Eastern Front. Notice, no big rifles, they have grenades, they have trench knives, they have clubs. They're the shock troops. Well, as the British penetration turned into a German rout, by December 7th, Haig was forced to give the order for a general retreat. Almost every inch of ground that they took was lost for nothing but death. 10,000 killed or died of their wounds. Another 49,000 were wounded. Plus 17,000 missing in action. Because of the German bombardments, their bodies were blown up so much, they couldn't be identified. Plus, as I said, half of the tank force knocked out. Whereas on the German side, 9,000 killed, 23,000 wounded, and 23,000 POWs. For what amounted to a few yards of land. Questions? That's how 1917 came to an end. Another battle. Let's go forward and let's get driven back. Let's go forward and let's get driven back. And let's have tens of thousands of men shot. Well, things got so bad that the Prime Minister of Great Britain, David Lloyd George, began engaging in a not-so-private argument with the commander-in-chief of the British Expeditionary Force. Haig blamed Lloyd George, claiming that he was sending too many troops on one of his little pet projects that were going on in the Middle East. Troops that should have gone to the Western Front. Well, Lloyd George claimed, said, if you weren't stupid and kept attacking at Ypres and wasting men in Flanders, maybe your Cambrai campaign could have won. Now, truth be told, Lloyd George did kind of have a stronger argument, but that's politics for you. All right, questions again, because now I think it's going to flip. All right. Fast forward to January 1918. We're now going into the fourth year of the war, and there is no end in sight. None. It looks like this war is going to go on to the end. Heck, even the calendars that were printed in 1918. Look, it's just we're going to recognize the boys because we're going to have a whole nother year of war. Yep. Although, truth be told, between the Brits and the French and their dugouts and the concrete bunkers of the Germans, I'd probably want to be on the German side, but that's just me. All right. Well, here's an interesting story. On January 8th, Prime Minister David Lloyd George, in a cabinet meeting, would make a bet with the Minister of War, Lord Derby. David Lloyd George bet 100 cigars that the war would go into 1919. And by then, the French might withdraw. The pendulum was completely going in the direction of Germany. Now keep in mind, ever since they got rid of the Schlieffen Plan, going back to Falkenhayn, the German plan was to take land and hold it and then negotiate. And give back some and get some. Well, let's just say, that's not the way things would turn out. Haig was similar to Lord Derby. Lord Derby believed Germany's going to run out of steam. And when they do, the end's going to come quick. Why? Well, very simple. Very simple. The games were changing. Derby, based on Haig's calculations, believed that if the Allies could hold out until August, by that point, the United States is going to be fully involved in the war. That the American troops will go from thousands to 10,000s to hundreds of thousands, possibly millions. And that there was no way the Germans had enough soldiers to fight the combined British, French, and American soldiers. So it was just a matter of holding out. Well, the politicians decided to intervene. For 3 years, it had been the Allied generals making all the decisions. And of course, as we know, we've covered all the major battles, and every single Allied offensive resulted in a loss, resulting in death. The politicians became fearful of potential socialist revolutions. And they knew they had to do something, or they would suffer the fate of Russia. So one of the most significant moves that they made was that the Allied leaders would get together and would create what became known as the Supreme War Council. This body would convene at the Palace of Versailles. And the job of the Supreme War Council was to plot a unified strategy. No more the French doing whatever they want and the English doing whatever they want. Now, everyone's going to be on the same page. Ironically, it was Lloyd George's idea. And in theory, it was created in November, but the first session was on January 29th, 1918. The job of the SWC was to check the field commanders, to bring the field commanders and their objectives back in line to what the politicians wanted. The SWC was co-chaired by the three prime ministers. You had David Lloyd George of England on top. You had newly elected Georges Clemenceau, who was elected in November 1917, prime minister of France. And Vittorio Orlando. Orlando was elected, I think, in October 1917. So these guys would meet in France, and they would talk with one another. Joining them would be the war ministers, or ministers of defense, whatever they were called. And they would select three permanent military representatives. Three permanent military representatives, PMRs. The PMRs would be the senior officer from each of the nation's general staffs. These men would not be allowed to have any other duties other than monitoring the conduct of the war. And they would serve as the technical advisors to the politicians. Kind of like the Joint Chiefs of Staff in our country. They're not allowed to have field commands. They're not going to lead men into battlefield. But rather, they're going to tell the prime ministers, okay, this is working, this is not. The senior PMR was the permanent military representative from France, Ferdinand Foch. Joining him would also be Sir Henry Wilson and Luigi Cardona. Not that we need to know that, but I thought I was going to put their pictures up, but I guess I didn't. All right. Let's talk a little bit about Foch. By the way, Haig despised Foch. If he could have shot him, he would have. The reason being, Foch was a politician military man. He was a larger-than-life figure who, after the war, would be regarded as one of the foremost military thinkers of his day. Because he is acknowledged as being a master of military strategy. Unlike many of the other generals, like the English nobles who were born into it, Foch studied. He had studied all of the great military minds over the centuries. He studied Napoleon. He studied Clausewitz, who was the Prussian general who helped beat Napoleon. He studied Robert E. Lee. He studied Grant and Sherman. He studied Moltke the Elder, as well as Napoleon III. He studied both sides of every single major battle and war that occurred. And he tried figuring out, okay, what allowed the winners to win? And what caused the losers to lose? Ironically, we haven't used this expression in a while, but he studied on the temple of offensive. He believed in the offensive. But unlike all of the other generals, he recognized, and I quote, recklessness in attack could lead to prohibitive losses, which would result in ultimate failure. In other words, attack when you can win. Don't be dumb. How did he get to this point? Well, when the war began, he actually was just a low-ranking divisional commander in the Second Army. His unit was actually one of the units that were forced to retreat in the Battle of the Frontiers when the Germans first crossed the border into Belgium, into France. Ironically, the units on either side of his were completely wiped out by the Germans. But because of his smart maneuvering, he managed to save almost his entire unit to pull way beyond the Germans before the Germans could catch up. As a result, he was rewarded and put in charge of the Ninth Army, which, if you remember, was the newly created army after the Germans got through that was used at the Battle of the Marne to drive the Germans back. Foch is credited with his counterattack being the spearhead thrust that almost sliced the first German army in half. If you remember when we talked about that, probably not, but no big deal. But essentially, he saved Paris because the Germans were within sight of the city. Late 1914, he would be named by Joffre as his replacement in case of an emergency. So we haven't mentioned him yet, because from basically late 1914 all the way up to 1916, he was one of the staff officers in Joffre's command. But when Joffre fell, blamed for the casualties and the losses he suffered, as punishment for being involved in Joffre's planning, which resulted in the death of millions of Frenchmen, he actually was given a field command of a reserve unit stationed in Italy, whose job was to basically keep one road secure. For somebody who was the second in command to be demoted to that level, that was huge humiliation. But he did it. He did it. He would be rehabilitated after Naval was humiliated and forced out. So he would be brought back and he would serve on Petain's general staff. But he had opinions. Strategy. Attack when you can win. Defend when you can't. While Haig hated Foch, he hated the British PMR, Henry Wilson, even more. Wilson was in London since 1915, and it was Wilson's job to report all of the operational details to the government. Well, when Wilson, one of the things he liked doing, whenever he read what Haig was planning, he would go into the politicians and say, look, this is stupid. This makes no sense. 1917, he comes over to France under orders of Lloyd George. And all the while Haig is planning his grand breakthrough in Flanders, Wilson is constantly reporting back to Lloyd George, this guy is insane. All he's going to do is get our boys killed. In fact, in the response of the letter to Lloyd George, he used the three following words: futile, fantastic, and dangerous. So these are the type of men that the field commanders are going to have to answer to. January 29th. At this first convening of the Supreme War Council, of course, the field commanders were called in and basically told to give a report. Haig and Petain argued they needed more men, because if they could get more men, they could create more German casualties. if they couldn't get more men, then let's join our forces and engage in an all-out British-French strike. But the SWC was not moved. They described what these two field commanders were requesting as, and I quote, absurd, panicky statements. Why? Well, as Foch advised the politicians, now is not the time to strike. Now is the time to engage in defense. If there was going to be an offense, only the soldiers already deployed could be used. Because what we needed was the knockout punch. So instead of sending each new unit immediately to the front, what Foch and Wilson decided the better strategy would be is to create a pool, which became known as the General Reserve. This would be a combined force of reserve units that you would give British and French and eventually American soldiers to. And this essentially would be a combined army. So when the time was right, you would take this massive force, like a sledgehammer, and bash your way through the lines, allowing the existing troops to hold their positions along the rest of the front. These would be fully integrated units, down to the divisional level. So you'd have a division of Americans, a division of French, a division of British, but the army groups would be combined. Smart. Build up your strength. Launch a concerted attack. The problem is, Haig was like, this is stupid. I'm not going to allow British men to fight under French commanders. Because what have the French done so far, other than fight like French? That's a joke, by the way. Ba-da-bum-sh. So, the General Reserve would actually be the pool that would begin collecting American soldiers. As ships of doughboys came over, instead of going right to the front, they would be sent to the General Reserve. And they would be unleashed in the summer. Questions. Now, the only exception to this, not used till the summer, the only exception was what I referred to a few minutes ago, what Lloyd George was doing down in the Middle East. David Lloyd George proposed essentially striking right into the gut of the Ottoman Empire, believing that once the Ottomans were knocked out of the war, then next would come Belgium, then would come the Austrians, and then would come the Germans. But instead of trying to blast their way through, where the Ottomans have their own, their largest strength, they decided they were going to launch an attack by land into the province of Palestine, as it was then called. Now, FYI, those of you who do not know geography, this is the bulk of Egypt proper, but you have the Gulf of Suez, and you have this triangle-shaped period that is part of Egypt
known as the Suez. Or sorry, Sinai. Suez Canal is there. England had established a protectorate over Egypt in 1904. So this technically was English land. The Ottomans in 1915, in retaliation for Gallipoli, would attempt to penetrate the Sinai, get to the Suez Canal, and begin sinking the British ships that were sailing through. Problem was, is they didn't get that far. They did penetrate. They definitely penetrated. But, in British protectorate, gold to shell the Suez Canal. But there we go. But the Brits managed to drive them out. Fast forward 1916. The Ottoman Empire would try again. But this time, they would use the veterans of Gallipoli. The men who successfully drove the Brits out. They were used to fighting the British. They understood the British mindset. So they were utilized to spearhead a thrust into the Sinai. And, geographically, they almost got toward the Suez Canal. They got pretty close. But when they stalled in 1916, they didn't withdraw. They occupied. So they would take possession of the land. And the plan was the following year to go to the canal. But before the Ottomans could strike, the Brits repositioned. They created what became known as the Desert Column. This was an army almost entirely of territorial forces. So there were Egyptians, there were Indians, as in from India, there were New Zealanders, there was a couple of units of even Scots. But these guys would be specially trained in desert warfare, and they essentially would be the force that would strike back against the Ottomans. Look. They actually rode camels instead of horses. All right. Once they went on the offensive, it wasn't that long, just a couple of months, before they managed to recapture all of Sinai. Then, by April, they moved into Gaza, the Gaza Strip. And by December 30th, 1917, they went as far north in capturing the city of Jerusalem. They essentially would take possession of Ottoman territory. Well, before moving any further, the Brits had to wait for another force that was joining them. Because concurrent, at the same time as the Brits were moving north, another army also was moving north. Because Lloyd George realized British territorial soldiers are not going to be enough to topple the Ottoman Empire. What was needed was people who lived within the empire. So Lloyd George, being an astute politician, did the enemy of my enemy is my friend triangulation, and he managed to win a huge ally, the Arabs. Yep. The Arab people had been subjugated by the Ottoman Turks ever since the 17th century.
Now, like with the Armenians, throughout most of the history, for the most part, the Arabs, they were not treated equally by the Turks, but they were not necessarily treated poorly. But in the 19th century, Arab nationalism began to rise, particularly as the people in the Baltics began breaking away. And the Arabs basically said, we're not Turks. Why should we be controlled by Turks? Why should we not have our own country? But the problem was, is like the Armenians, prior to World War I, they really weren't organized, nor were they militaristic. They were, as I have described it here, for the most part, they were moderate. So, to a degree, they were willing members of the empire, and they were tolerant of other people. Ironically, when the Young Turk Revolt occurred in 1918, they joined with them to topple the Sultan and to reestablish the constitution, to give rights and privileges to the people. Fighting alongside of the Young Turks, as well as the Armenians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, and all of the other people who wanted equality. But we know what happened to the Young Turks. They experienced that metamorphosis. They became ultra-nationalistic Turkish Islamists. And they wanted to create a homogeneous society by wiping out diversity and making everybody Turkish Muslims. Well, the Arabs started hearing what the Turks were doing to the Armenians and the Christians. And they started realizing, if they're going to do it to them, we're next. So in 1916, they decided to revolt. Armed bands of Arabs would rise up and would spontaneously seize the holy city of Mecca. When that occurred, the Brits contacted them and made promises, secret treaties. They said to the House of Saud, the ruling family, that if you join with this, all of this will become yours. And so, 1916, 1917, they slowly marched and they knocked out Turkish positions, getting themselves all the way up into this region that was known as Transjordan. And they literally would merge up with the British Desert Column, creating a massive military force aimed at toppling the Ottoman Empire. But we gotta wait till Thursday or Tuesday to find out what happened. No spoilers. Questions? So long story short, men, munitions, supplies, even though they were stockpiling strength in the West, there was a strong filter that would come down because the goal was to knock the Turks out. Transjordan. All right. Well, then, while that was going on in Germany, there also was planning and strategizing going on. But while the Allies were bickering, Erich Ludendorff would use his political prestige and he would begin consolidating control, not only of the military, but also over the political reins of power. Essentially, it was akin to a military takeover of the imperial regime. How did Ludendorff get there? Well, if you remember, we haven't mentioned his name. He was the chief aide to Hindenburg, And in 1914, both men were sent to fight in the Eastern Front. They achieved a brilliant victory at the Battle of Tannenberg. And they helped smash the first and the second Russian army that would lead to the Galicia Campaign, which resulted in the seizure of Poland. But Falkenhayn, because of the mess of Verdun, would be sent to a field command, and Hindenburg would be invited to Berlin. And he would take over as the chief of the general staff. Ludendorff would serve as his quartermaster. Quartermaster is the officer that controls all of the supplies. And he also was made general of the infantry. So as a result, even though technically Hindenburg was higher ranking, Ludendorff essentially had control over every aspect of the war. And he would use his power to make sure nobody stood in his way. It would be his way or no way. Now, he didn't have all that power at first. It would be taken. Because even though Germany was a monarchy, it was a constitutional monarchy, and there was a legislative branch called the Reichstag. Now, when Bismarck made Germany, in the Constitution, he did give some power to the Reichstag, but not much. The Reichstag, for example, had the taxing power. The Reichstag had the ability to regulate the economy to a degree. And the Reichstag also had the power of appropriation, so they could spend. They could tax, regulate, and spend. And they also could make laws. But the head of the Reichstag, the chairman, was the chancellor. So the chancellor controlled the agenda. Since 1909, the chancellor was Theobald von Bethlen Hollweg. Bethlen Hollweg came from a high-ranking noble family that had long history and traditions being connected with the Prussian monarch. Whereas Erich von Ludendorff, his family, was a lower house. So von Bethlen Hollweg couldn't stand Ludendorff because he viewed him as a paper tiger. He was a wannabe. He claimed to have this air of invincibility, but he had no right to have that type of reputation. Because who brought victory? It wasn't him. It was Hindenburg. But Ludendorff was crafty. He had a keen political mind for chicanery. For a year, he waited for an opportunity to move. And it fell into his lap in the spring of 1917. With the blessing of the Kaiser, if you recall, in the spring of 1917, he signed off on unrestricted submarine warfare. Well, the politicians that were in the Reichstag decided to issue a resolution for peace. Despite the fact that this time the Tsar has abdicated, Russia's on the verge of collapse, the Allies are getting smashed on the way. I mean, everything's going in Germany's directions. The Reichstag basically says, we want peace and we're not going to look for more land or money. We just want to end the war. Essentially, they wanted to reset everything back to 1914. Well, how do you think the generals reacted to this? Very simple. The chancellor would be the guinea pig. Because who controls the agenda? The chancellor does. And who allowed this resolution to pass? The chancellor did. So, Hindenburg went to the Kaiser and convinced the Kaiser to demand the chancellor's resignation. And by the way, if the Kaiser tells you to quit your job, you quit. With Bethlen-Hollweg out, Ludendorff was able to put in one of his puppets, a stooge, George Michaelis. Michaelis was elderly, in bad health, and he did nothing to interfere with the military whatsoever, because he was just happy to get the title. And of course, the paycheck that came with it. Because unlike the others, he was not a noble. He was a commoner. This was a shot fired across the bow of the politicians that even the dumbest politician figured out what would happen to them if they tried to move like they did with the resolution again. The Reichstag began voting for everything that Ludendorff asked for. All of the money, all of the appropriations, whatever was necessary to win. And Ludendorff drank it up. And his head became two sizes larger. And soon he would descend into megalomania. It became all about him and not the German people. Once he had control, he completely ignored the reality of what was going on in Germany. By 1917, the home front was collapsing. Not as bad as what happened in Russia, but it wasn't that far off. The people were hungry. The people were cold, literally cold. Food production diminished. There was no extra coal. There was no oil. All the reserves went to the military. And the war-weary population began taking to the streets and calling for an end to the war. Strikes, riots would erupt. But interestingly, I've never read anything that implied that what was going on in 1917, the blame was not fixed on the Kaiser. It wasn't a political uprising, but rather it was an uprising out of desperation. The average caloric intake had dropped by about 60% as it was pre-war. So these people were hangry. FYI, how bad was it? It's estimated by some historians that upwards of 750,000 civilians would starve to death during the war. There was just no food. So what did the government do? Did they meet with the people? No. They arrested the strike leaders. They sent units of soldiers to brutally repress the riots. If you questioned, you would be labeled a traitor or a foreign subversive. And you know what the government does to traitors?
Execute them.
Firing squads. Although they stopped using bullets by 1917 and they brought back the guillotine.
Now all Ludendorff had to do is do something for the people. Make sure that more food was going to the cities. Something. Something.
But Ludendorff, in his megalomania, believed the one thing the people really wanted was victory. So we're not going to help the people. We're going to continue to fight till we win. And then we can take the spoils. All the food from the French. All the coal, the oil, all the stuff for the French. And give it to the German people for their loyalty. Dumbass. So, to win the war. It's really weird that the strategies would completely shift. Since 1914, the Germans were always on the defensive for the most part. And it was the Allies always on the offensive. But for 1918, Ludendorff came up with something new. In tribute of the people. He formulated what was known as the Kaiserschlacht. The Kaiser's battle. This would be a patriotic offensive that would cripple the Allies before the Americans could fully get in. Now, as you can see by the red dots, it was actually not just a offensive, but it was four offensives that would go 1, 2, 3, 4 sequentially. So you're not just going to hit the Allies in one spot. You're going to basically start four battles that are all going to kind of go on at the same time. And in the end, you're going to end up killing the British, killing the French. The lines will give way, and then you're going to race to Paris. Each of the offenses had a name. Operation Michael, Operation Georgette, Operation Gauzenau, Operation Blücher-York. But the main attack would be Operation Michael. This was located here. This is the point where the British and the French armies come together. And because Haig hated Petain by this point and was not getting along with the SWC, Haig had pulled most of his forces closer to Flanders. Because guess what he was planning? This would create about an 80-mile stretch where there were few men. And the Germans picked up on it. So they would, like a cudgel, bash their way through this massive weak point that had developed because of squabbling. Junction between two armies. Ludendorff believed if you could cleave the lines in two, the Brits would curl up into Flanders and possibly flee across the channel. And the French would curl south, creating this massive pathway to Paris. Well, Ludendorff also believed before Paris would fall, France would quickly go to the negotiating table to save the city. And then the moment France begins to negotiate, England's going to get mad and they're going to pull their troops out and basically abandon the French. And who cares about the Americans? Pure Ludendorff. Pure Ludendorff. Every last detail was planned out. But, strategically speaking, it was flawed. Because in order for it to work, you would have to punch a hole in a straight line and everything would have to line up perfectly. 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 sequentially. But if anything was a little off, you'd end up missing. Problem is you can't win a war with just strategy alone. It's speaking of strategy, he had changed the game. He was amazed at the effectiveness of the start of the Battle of Cambrai. But it was simple. Every other battle up to this point, it started with a massive bombardment, so you kind of tell the enemy you're coming. So this time around, we're not going to open up our artillery. So they're not going to suspect that we're coming. Instead, what they would do is short bursts. The goal was not to punch holes through the line, but the goal was to trigger basically shell shock. So you catch the enemy off guard, and you rattle them up at different points along this 80-mile stretch. Because then once they're in that haze, they would be slow to respond because they weren't sure exactly where the attack was coming. Then, infantry charge. But, like what was learned at Cambrai, it was not one big surge. But rather, it was the small groups, small units, and they were told to go with speed. To keep penetrating the lines at weak points. And if you come across a stronghold, you shift and you go elsewhere. Then, like an assembly line, once the front wave is through, then you bring the reserves behind and you mop up those strong points. This would ensure the attack doesn't lose momentum because the guys in the front are going to continue to run. They're going to continue to charge. They're going to continue to advance the lines. So, in effect, they would act like hundreds of termites. It's a nice analogy I have there. I was clever when I first wrote that class. That was a good thing I thought of. I like that. So termites, when they attack a 2x4, they don't all go at the same time. They begin attacking it from different points, finding the soft points. And eventually they slowly begin to penetrate it and they eat it up from within. That would allow them to consume it in entirety. In terms of scale, this was huge. Almost 3/4 of German strength would be utilized in this massive wave of offenses. First, he would move 50 divisions that were no longer needed in the east because of Brest-Litovsk, and he would ship them to the west, giving Germany the numeric superiority. There was 241 German divisions against 192 Allied divisions. Now, Ludendorff knew the Americans were coming, but it was like a slow drip. After all, they had to sail across the Atlantic Ocean. So Ludendorff believed this would be the punch. The plan, you take your strength and you divide them up into 3 separate units. Of the 241 units, 174 would be used. The first wave would be 44 units of the Stoßtruppen, the storm troops. These were the alpha dogs of the German fighting force. These were the youngest, the strongest, the fastest. They were given the tools not for a fixed piece strike, but rather they were given the tools of terror. Trench mortars, flamethrowers, grenades. Anything to rip holes through the lines. Following on their heels were 30 divisions of the Angriffstruppen, which are the attack units, the attack troops. So the stormtroopers penetrate, the attack groups come in and lock down the strong positions. And then finally, you would have the reserves that would be moved in to hold the positions. The Schützengrabentruppen, the trench soldiers. The top fit the strong. The average. And then the not so healthy, the not so quick. Hey, fat guys. All their job was just to hold the lines. This would allow them to move everything forward, to simultaneously penetrate, break to open space, but lock down what was behind them. They would bring in 10. I thought there was a click. I didn't realize this one was here. I'm almost done. I know we're almost out of time. 10,500 fully loaded trains transported the men and the supplies into position. Each unit had machine guns, heavy machine guns, light machine guns. Some of the guys actually had the first primitive body armor. I mean, this was going to be as sick as you could get. And, ironically, Ludendorff had a hole-in-one. And right at the point when he's planned to start, the Allies were on the verge of ripping themselves apart. Haig and Lloyd George were bickering at one another. Haig kept requesting more men. He kept saying he's hearing something, but he needs more men to stop it. And Lloyd George says, no, all the extra men, they're going to go to the Middle East. So as a result, the total reserve troops for the Brits would drop down to about 70,000. Not a lot of men. Plus, to make matters worse, Army intelligence was reporting the German planes are flying over this 80-mile stretch with somewhat repetitivity. Maybe we should reposition our men to kind of close the gap. Haig's response, Foch can deal with it. Haig was convinced that the Germans are going to come through Flanders, because why would you want to do it in the middle of the lines? You want to kind of do it on the end. In fact, on the eve of the attack, Flanders was where he, in all his intelligence, said it was coming. He predicted the strike about the time it would start, 40 miles closer to the channel. So he took all the strength that he could have and he moved them away. So what was there? The smallest of all the British armies, the British 5th, under the command of General Hubert Gough. Imagine taking about 50,000 men and trying to guard 80 miles of space. Could you do it?
Probably not.
Probably not. Gough repeatedly warned Haig, look, if anyone's paying attention, this is the weak spot. You've just created this. But Haig was like, nah, the Germans don't. They're not going to. Their morale is broken. They don't want to fight anymore. Our boys, they're tougher. We'll win because they said so. And to make matters worse, because he was convinced that it was coming in Flanders and that would give him the ability to counter, and I kid you not, 18 days before the German troops attacked, he granted leaves for 90,000 British soldiers. They were pulled off the lines and allowed to go back to the countryside to go drink, eat French bread, and sleep with French women. Which meant the entire section of the British line, about 80 miles, no, sorry, longer than that, 160 miles, about 120,000 soldiers. And lastly, and this is where we'll end it,
as bad as all this was, Haig had now, in addition to fighting with Lloyd George and Wilson and Foch, Haig also started arguments with Pétain.
They refused to coordinate with one another. So, if the Germans attacked the French, Haig would not send British reserves to help them, and vice versa. It was the perfect storm of stupidity. Well, we'll find out what happened on Thursday. Now, before I let you go, a couple of things. Papers are due on Friday. They have to be dropped in the drop box and engaged. That's 20% of your grade. Make sure you get it in. Make sure when you drop it in the drop box, you click that it's the final draft. There's two buttons you have to click. Don't just drop it in and click the first, because that will come in as a draft and I won't be able to grade it. I need it to be the final draft. If it doesn't take, do it again. Second, we're down to 4 classes left. Thursday, Tuesday, Thursday, Tuesday. Your final exam is on the 9th, because somebody's going to have to spend an extra semester because I don't want to let her go. So, the end is going to come quick. And you guys are going to be the first class that I'm going to tell you now. I haven't told my other two. I'm not going to be here next Thursday. So on Tuesday, I'm going to come in. I'm going to teach, get us as far as we can get. I'm going to rush home, and I'm going to do a video. And that's going to bring us almost to the end. And you're going to have to watch it on the YouTube, because I'm going to be out in Indianapolis. I have to go to a conference. So we're almost there, my friends. Almost there. Don't quit on me now, because it's only 55% of your final grade that's left. So, all right. We'll see you on Thursday.